today I'm here with Professor Carl Richard, who is a history professor, and he's here to talk to us about the fall of Rome and hopefully other similar societies and sort of some of the dynamics on why those might happen. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and your background?
Well, I'm originally from Louisiana, which is where I teach now. This was my alma mater as an undergraduate. I got my PhD at Vanderbilt University, and I've always had an interest in the ancient world, Greece and Rome and so on. But the languages you need to learn is really four to even get started: Greek, Latin, French, and German. And I had the Greek and the French, but didn't have the Latin and the German. And I was a very impatient young man, and I was going to have to do all of this tremendous language work to even get started. And so I decided actually to go into American history. My PhD is actually in American history, American intellectual history. But I was interested in the founding fathers and the American Revolution. And so my mentor, Paul Konkin, suggested, well, why don't you do the influence of Greece and Rome on the founding fathers? And I said, you can do that? And he said, yes. So I said, well, that's great. And that actually was my first book, The Founders and the Classics, was published by Harvard University Press in 1994. But I became more and more interested in the ancients doing that work. And so some of my books have been, geared toward the influence of Greece and Rome in the Western world, including the United States, and others have been more about the ancient world itself. So it's been kind of a combination.
And you spoke at Freedom Fest, where I was an attendee.
Right.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what you spoke about there? And I mean, actually, maybe we should, if you, I'll describe. So Freedom Fest is the world's largest libertarian conference, and it was about a month and a half ago or so. And there was the theme of the conference was the fall of Rome, and so Carl was one of the sort of the leading speakers on this topic, and certainly had I think more detail than anybody else. Do you want to just maybe a little bit about what you spoke about out there?
Sure. I was invited by Mark Skousen, who's the founder and organizer of Freedom Fest. And the interesting thing about that is that the reason why he contacted me was he read one of my most recent books, which is called Why We're All Romans. And he was going to do the theme of Are We Rome? And so he decided to contact me based on my expertise. And the funny thing about that is he didn't know what my political views were. He really brought me in as a historian. And I guess fortunately for him and the conference, I would classify myself as a conservative, but certainly with libertarian leanings. And so I was, many academics who were experts on Rome might not have been comfortable at that conference because they tend to be pretty liberal. But actually, I was very comfortable, and I really enjoyed it quite a bit.
Have you become more libertarian since the conference?
I don't know if I've become more libertarian since the conference. I think I was probably already about 80% libertarian. I think my only differences with libertarians tend to be on a little bit social, the legalized drugs and things like that I'm not too keen on, and maybe some of the foreign policy. Although even in foreign policy, I think I've gotten more libertarian as I've seen some of these interventions, drag on and not be very useful, in my opinion. So I've even, maybe in that area, foreign policy have become a little bit more libertarian.
Oh, I mean, I think the libertarians are mildly crackpots, but I really like them, and I'm considering myself a libertarian. I think some of the views are very extreme, but it's just an interesting crowd.
Well, I've changed some of my opinion. I used to believe, as most people do, well, there are certain things the government has to do, for instance, build roads and have a postal system and so on. These things we were raised to believe were normal and necessary. And I've changed even on those things. I mean, I look at what Mitch Daniels has done in Indiana with toll roads and I look at FedEx and UPS, and I begin to wonder even about those few things that I thought government had to do.
Interesting. So this past weekend, I went to visit Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's house. And Thomas Jefferson is a pretty important guy, I'm sure, for these topics that we're talking about. I wanted to go and see how he lived. One thing that surprised me was that his house was a lot smaller than I expected. But the thing that I found that was really interesting was how much of a geek he was. He had a... In the living room or the dining room, he had a device that he could put in an empty bottle of wine, and within a few seconds, up would come a full bottle of wine, and he would accomplish that by having a slave waiting downstairs that could rotate the pulleys and do this. He had a whole lot of other things, like he had his doors to the living room were glass, and you opened one and the other one was connected by a pulley, and that was sort of the first time that had ever existed anywhere. He had the roof of the house was sloping, that was carefully designed so that the rainwater would be funneled off very efficiently. And in fact, I've actually seen that in northern Haiti. It's the only other place I've seen a sloping roof like that, and we know that the Haitians copied the Declaration of Independence, so they may have actually gone and visited him at Monticello. Wouldn't surprise me at all. I think he had the double glazed windows, which was sort of the first that had ever been in the US. And it was just interesting. He did a lot of reading from books and built the design of his house out of that. Looking at all of this, I would suggest that Thomas Jefferson might have been America's first geek.
Well, I mean, he was an incredible man. I mean, he was a great scientist and inventor. He invented an odometer for his carriage that measured the mileage. He actually invented the roll-down map, which I didn't know until I read about that. And he invented a primitive copy machine. It was basically quill pens tied together. So when he wrote on one, the others copied what he was writing. He was an incredible scientist and inventor, and he's often portrayed as this forward-looking man, which he certainly was, but he was also very well-educated in history, and especially in Greek and Roman history. And you mentioned architecture. I mean, his preference, he was an architect as well. I mean, he developed the University of Virginia campus. He had a lot of influence in the U.S. Capitol, the construction of the U.S. Capitol, various other buildings, and he tended to favor Roman architecture. He loved the domes, the spherical shape, combined with the Greek columns.
Right. And
we see that everywhere in his architecture.
So was he the key founding father that got the fall of Rome ideas into, because there was a book by Edward Gibbons published in 1776 on the fall of Rome that was highly influential. Was it Thomas Jefferson the main guy, or were there others that were also reading that and basing the founding documents on that stuff?
Well, Jefferson was exceptionally well educated, but actually most of the founders were steeped in Greek and Roman history, because that was their educational system. The so-called grammar school, which I always thought referred to English grammar from the beginning, but it didn't. It referred to Latin grammar. That's what they studied, Greek and Latin, but especially Latin. And they studied that for years and years, and then they went to college and studied it usually three more years out of four. And so they were steeped in Greek and Roman history, and it really influenced the American Revolution, because they saw themselves as recreating the ancient republics. And so they were almost all steeped in the classics. And they were especially interested in, I think, the late Roman Republic, because they, you know, here they were establishing a new Roman Republic. They even used Roman architecture for the capital. They used names like the Senate for the upper branch. They were trying to recreate the Roman Republic in a sense, and so they were very much concerned, well, what is it that killed the original Roman Republic? And so they were, I would say they were more fascinated by the fall of the Roman Republic than they were by the fall of the Roman Empire, because those two things were separated by five centuries. difference.
Right, 500 years difference, right.
Yeah, and so, the you know, when they talked about the fall of Rome, they didn't mean the empire, they meant the republic.
Interesting, okay. And so, I mean, Jefferson was definitely influenced by this stuff in a lot of detail, right? I mean, and one of the impressions I've gotten, because I grew up in Australia, we don't particularly have much guns. I don't like guns. I've never owned a gun. libertarians are obviously pretty big into their guns. And one of the things is the ability to bear arms that's always fought over back and forth. And it started to make me think that effectively one of the things that the Founding Fathers did by putting that into the founding documents was that the most of the guys that are going to hold guns are going to tend to have right-leaning viewpoints, and that almost acts as a backstop against the country drifting too far to the left. Would you agree with that?
I do. I mean, I think that, you know, the people on the left, they talk about how the Second Amendment mentions militias, and therefore that was the sole intent of it, was to have state militias that could defend the country if it was attacked by foreign powers. But what they fail to understand is that the militia was every able-bodied male. So it was not a reference to defending the country from foreign powers. The whole Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, were insisted upon by the anti-federalists, who were afraid the federal government was too strong under this new constitution. They insisted on these amendments, and they were all geared at limiting the federal government's power. If you read the First Amendment, for instance, it says Congress, the federal Congress, shall make no law to infringe on the rights of free speech and religion and so on. So, I mean, these amendments were all directed at the federal government. They were insisted upon by the anti-federalists to limit federal power. That's what they were designed to do. So when it talks about a militia in the Second Amendment, it's talking about every individual, you know, able-bodied male having a right to a weapon, not just to defend against foreign powers, but to defend against federal tyranny.
Right. In some of the, actually, just as a related note, I mean, I grew up as I would think a reasonably well-educated person, and I'd heard of the idea of the fall of Rome, and not really thought much about it. I went to Angkor Wat in Cambodia a year and a half ago, took lots of photos, had a really nice time, and you know, I'm aware that there's Machu Picchu and all of these other cities around the world, but had never given any thought whatsoever that there might be specific reasons why all of these societies fail, and that did actually fail. I kind of just thought that maybe everybody in the city moved. I didn't really give it much thought. I'm wondering if that's more of a general opinion these days, and we're less aware of what's happened in the past.
Well, I think in the founders' generation, you know, back during the Enlightenment in the 18th century, they thought very much in terms of lessons of history, and that societies repeated certain mistakes, and that if we could learn from this and prevent our own society from falling as a result. Today we've come, and they tended to be sometimes a little naive in trying to apply lessons from one time to another, but I think we've gotten to the opposite extreme in academia today, where we're taught all cultures are completely different, and therefore you cannot learn any lessons. In fact, they hate that term of learning lessons because they think it's naive. But I think they go too far in that direction, because there certainly is a common human nature, and therefore there are common human problems, and there are common responses to those problems. And because there is a common human nature, I think we can learn from the ancient societies and other societies. Now we do have to be careful, because there are differences in historical context.
Right.
But I think we can learn, because I believe there is a common human nature that leads to, the way I like it is, it was once said that history does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
Interesting. Could we suggest that, well, I read there's a book by Joseph Tainter, The Collapse of Complex Societies, or something like that in the title. And his general thesis is that societies reach a level of complexity, and the costs of continuing to grow the society outweigh the costs of continuing to run it, and so at some point people scatter. And that you can do things to increase those costs on the system. For example, communism is a way to increase the cost of keeping the society going, and that will make it fail faster. And I mean, as me being now quite right-wing, I would put all left-wing movements into fairly expensive in terms of keeping the system running. Would you agree with that?
I do. I mean, I think government is to some extent parasitical. I mean, it can only exist in a society that is producing wealth, and the wealth does not come from the government. It comes from private enterprise, and if you tax private enterprise too much, you're killing the goose that lays the golden eggs. And when I say tax, it's not just taxes, but regulations. I read somewhere that businesses, American businesses, are now spending twice as much money to comply with government regulations as they're spending in taxes. Well, that's a tax. Anytime government says you must do something and it costs you money to do it, that's a tax. So I think this, the private enterprise in America is being taxed tremendously right now.
Does this one thing that I noticed that as something as a trend, and this is just my own observation, and I'm curious into your opinion of how accurate it is, that and that they don't all follow this trend, but a couple of them seem to, in that we have a very, when a nation is being built, there's a very right-wing phase where it's being built. We then reach a level of stability where there's a lot of problems, and then we switch to a left-wing phase to even out things and make things nicer for everybody. That weakens the country, and then as things get weaker and weaker, then the costs go up, and then we enter what I'd almost consider an extreme left-wing phase where we have a new religion appears and then drags things down. And I mean, we know from the fall of the Roman Empire that there was the barbarians attacking and a whole lot of things going on. I mean, people were putting themselves into slavery because the taxes were so high that it was better to become a slave for someone and work for them and get paid than have to pay the taxes. And so they, of course, passed a law to ban people from voluntarily becoming slaves. But as a cycle, right-wing, left-wing religion, how many societies would you think would fit that pattern?
I think it makes sense. I mean, I think obviously you have to have that private base to build government to begin with. And so, as I said, government is somewhat parasitical. And so obviously it's only a prosperous society that can even consider government doing all of these functions. And I think you're right. I mean, I think as time goes on, as society becomes richer, they begin to look at things that government could do that to make life better, especially for those less fortunate people. But it becomes problematic because, there's the old saying about, we need a safety net, but we don't want it to become a hammock. And I think it often does. I mean, it's just human nature that if government is going to do all of these things for you, you will stop doing them for yourself.
Have you ever read the book called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt from NYU?
No, I haven't.
You might find it interesting. It's about the left and right filters that generally are used. And what ends up happening is when you view the world through one filter, you get very polarized on that view, and it becomes impossible to see things from the other side. And one of the things that I'm suspicious of is that as we become left, the left becomes very strong because it's the moral case, and the moral case, it's very easy to say, these poor people that are being, everything's going wrong for them and they need help, and it's, they're generally, a lot of the times they're right, and it's easy to support the moral case, and I think it might be easier to support the moral case than the productive case.
Well, I think the left is just, in this country anyway, is much better at public relations. As you said, I mean, they're able to trot out these people for the cameras who have suffered hardship and say, well, how can you take bread out of their mouths and so on? Whereas it's more difficult for the right. They What they would have to do to compensate would be to perhaps bring up small business people or people like that who are struggling to pay the taxes and struggling to deal with the regulations. And maybe they're not quite as telegenic, or maybe the right is just not as adept at using people like that, or maybe they're even in a sense more ethical and don't want to do that, or maybe they want to aim their argument more at the rational level rather than the emotional level. But unfortunately, the public tends to decide things. And Cicero said this, by the way. You know, he said he wrote a book called The Orator, about how to be a great orator. He was the greatest orator of his day. And he said you have to appeal to emotion. He said people more often decide things by emotion than they do by reason. Unfortunately, it's just human nature.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the right can always put up some angry white guys complaining, but, you know, I think it's almost becoming illegal to be an angry white guy in the U.S. now, so that doesn't work very well anymore.
Right. You have to be part of a certain victim group, I think, to be heard.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit more about the influence of Rome on the founding fathers and what kind of things really stuck out to them, and what kind of things did they embed in the founding documents of the United States?
Well, I think maybe the most important thing structurally was this idea of mixed government. And this went back to the ancient Greeks, but the Romans were the ones, like, as in so many cases, the Romans were the ones who actually made it work and gave them a model. Mixed government was this theory that Plato first threw out, and Aristotle picked it up and ran with it, and Cicero really emphasized it. And it was this idea that the best form of government would balance the power of the one, the few, and the many. The one being the king or the executive or the leader, the few being the rich, the well-born, and the many being the masses. And Plato said, you know, if you give all the power to one person or group, they will abuse it. And so they each have to have a veto, basically, the one, the few, and the many. And the Greeks talked about this, but they didn't really come up with a great model that could be followed. The Romans did. I mean, the Roman Republic basically had a balance between, actually it wasn't the one in their case, it was the two. They had two consuls who were the executives, then they had the Senate, which was the aristocratic body, and then they had the popular assemblies where the masses could make their voice heard. And Cicero especially was so influential, because remember that the founders' educational system was Latin. It was almost all Latin. And so they read Cicero. They wanted to emulate Cicero. He was the great orator, and they wanted to be great orators. He was a great statesman, and they wanted to be great statesmen. And he, of course, died as a martyr for republicanism. So they almost really revered this man. And he wrote about this in a book called The Republic. And he said, this is the secret of Roman success. We have this mixed government. And so when the founders got together in Philadelphia to construct the Constitution, they said, we want a mixed government just like Rome had, Roman Republic had. And so what did they do? They created a king, a president. They didn't have that under the original Constitution, the Articles of Confederation. They said, we need a strong executive. And then the Senate, they even gave it the same name as the Romans' aristocratic body. And what did they? How did they construct this Senate? They said the senators originally were not popularly elected. They were chosen by the state legislatures. They were given these big terms, six-year terms, to insulate them from mob pressure so that they could be sort of this aristocratic body. And then the House of Representatives, which was directly elected every 2 years. And so that was to be the organ through which the mass will would be heard. So they created a system that was like the Roman system based on this classical theory of mixed government.
But the Roman system failed.
It did. Of course, all systems eventually fail. And so they knew that. They knew the Roman system failed. And so they were also almost obsessed with conducting what I would call an autopsy on the Roman Republic to find out what killed it. But they didn't think it was mixed government that killed it. They thought it was mixed government that made it strong. And it was other things, corruption and various other factors that caused the Republic to fall.
So what were the factors that they did think that caused Rome to fall then?
Well, corruption, or what they would call moral decline. And this is something that we see in every level. I mean, the people were becoming more corrupt at all levels. The farmers were losing their land, and they were moving to the city, or voluntarily leaving their land in some cases. They were moving to the cities where they're becoming sort of mobs. Government was trying to placate them with the dole, very much like the sort of the modern food stamp program. So the masses were getting corrupt, but so were the aristocrats. They were engaged in ballot box stuffing and bribery and all kinds of corruption. And so that was one of the things the founders emphasized, was the corruption in all levels of Roman society. And there was an analogy there, because if you look at the early Roman Republic, which the founders revered, it was based on these various virtues, as the founders called them. Things like the early Romans were very religious, just like early Americans were very religious, pious, they would say. They were hardworking, just like early American settlers were hardworking. They were frugal. They saved their money. They didn't blow their money, both the early Americans and the early Romans. Self-disciplined. So they had a lot of the same qualities. And what happened in the late Republic was they lost those qualities. They lost all the virtues that had made them so successful. And founders were worried that the same thing would happen in America. And I would argue in our own time, a lot of that has happened.
One of the things from the Gibbons book is that the Romans became quite effeminate. Do you know why that was?
Well, the term effeminate was used by the Romans and also by the founders to really mean certain qualities of luxurious, because there was a classical idea that luxury was a feminine thing. You know, the early Romans were these hard men, you know, tough, hardworking, and so on, dependent. And that's another thing that was called effeminate, being dependent on someone else. A real man was someone who was independent. And that's why, for instance, Jefferson was against factory workers voting. You know, he said they're dependent on their employers. You know, he believed in the small farmer who was independent. He didn't have a boss, and so he was independent. And, you know, it's interesting, the very word virtue, which the founders loved to use and spoke about a lot, that's a Roman word. That's a Latin word. And the word, actually, virtue comes from the first three letters. Vir Latin, it's called vir. It's the word for man. And so they, when they spoke of virtue, they spoke of manly qualities.
So when in the Gibbons book, when he's talking about being effeminate, and then what we have today with modern day feminism, would you see those as being two completely different things, or is there some correlation?
There might be some correlation. They're somewhat different, but I think some people would say that there's been a concerted effort by feminists and others to sort of take away the manly qualities of the American male. That might be a connection there, that the Romans and the founders were afraid of, you know, when they used the word effeminate, they were afraid of men losing those sort of manly qualities that they believed were crucial in society.
I think in the U.S. today, like, there's a fear that things could go bad, but we don't really, I don't hear much talk about comparing it to the fall of Rome. And that we kind of think that we have democracy and things will just continue to work. But really we're relying on the ideas of people 200 plus years ago, and they're untested. We don't know if they're going to work.
Well, I don't know. Well, it depends on what you mean by untested. I mean, I would say it was tested for two centuries and worked pretty well, and it's only recently that it's declined. I certainly don't think that we're at the point that Rome was right before it fell.
Right.
But I think we may be in a kind of a late imperial period unless we're able to correct our problems. And I think certainly, you know, we've had a problem with debt for decades, but it certainly has accelerated. And I think a lot of these things have accelerated. And that's the problem, I think, is that it's as each year goes by, it becomes harder and harder to reverse course. I think, for instance, if you look at how did the Roman government in the late years, which engaged in this extremely excessive spending, how did it pay for these things? Well, there are two methods. One was taxation, and taxes got higher and higher. And the other one was devaluing the coinage. They couldn't do the third one, which is debt, because the banking system wasn't big enough to support the Roman government. So they used these other two means, and they devalued the currency so badly that by the end of it, by the end of the empire, so-called silver coin was only 2% silver, and the Roman government would no longer accept its own money and taxes. You had to give goods to the tax man. He wouldn't take their own money. Well, we're not to that point yet, but certainly the Fed has created over $2 trillion in money the last few years. And, of course, we have high taxes. We also have high debt. So we've got all three. And it's not at the point that Rome was at the very end, but it's getting there.
Were there any strong left-wing movements in Rome or Greece or any of these other countries?
No, not by modern standards, I don't think. Now, so you can pick out certain things like the dole, for instance. The fact they had this kind of primitive welfare program in which they gave free food to the poor. That's analogous to our food stamp program or something like that. But that was about it. I mean, they just did not have the welfare state that we have today. And so the excessive spending was really by the emperors. You know, they built these lavish palaces. They also spent a lot of money bribing the army so they wouldn't get overthrown. And that was a big problem that the Roman Empire had. And this, I think this is an advantage that we have today. They had no stable system of succession, these emperors. Usually they were the strongest general. And so some other strong general would try to overthrow them, some cases succeed, some cases fail. But the emperors always felt like they had to keep bribing the army more and more to keep themselves from being overthrown. And this is not a problem we have today. I think our soldiers are loyal to the country, not to their generals, and I don't think we have to worry about that. On the other hand, this welfare state that we have has a broader base of support because it's so much bigger and so many people are getting benefits from it. It makes it that much more difficult to reverse. So that's kind of a disadvantage that I think we have.
We have a strong democratic process, and I mean, that was tested fairly well during the election that Gore ran, because that was a pretty tough time for a lot of people, I think. But things did hold together, they didn't break down. I lived in the Caribbean for about 10 years, and there was a couple of elections down there where, like, the U.S. actually had, we heard afterwards that the U.S. had been leaning on the government to do the right thing, because it was getting to the point where guys were talking about getting guns and taking the country back after the election because they were so annoyed. We don't have that stuff here in the U.S. And I'm curious as to your thoughts on the strength of the base left-right democracy in Rome.
I think we do. That is a major advantage that we have. We have a stable system of succession. When presidents lose re-election, they leave. I mean, we saw it many times. We saw it with Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter and George Bush Sr. You know, when incumbents lose, they leave. They leave office. And when one, even if it's not incumbent, incumbent party will leave office when the other party wins. And we take that for granted, but that's really an incredible thing in the history of the world. And so I think that's our strength. The only problem that I foresee is that if our economic conditions get worse and worse to the point where people began to really suffer, if there's ever a point at which people are going hungry or something like that because of inflationary spiral or something like that, then we might have a problem. But until then, I think our system seems to work.
And so one of the things that I've looked at from past elections is that every so often there will be a political realignment. And that's where there's a major shift in the voting patterns, and there could even be a new party, although they don't seem, I think it seems like we'll stick with the same parties, but there will be a major shift. And it would seem like that could potentially happen with the Libertarians. Is that something that, that you see as a potential thing, where we end up with a Libertarian president?
It's very difficult in this country. The system is really rigged to be a two-party system. Now, there have been cases in the past where major parties, because of some great crisis, have fallen and a different party has arisen to become the other of the two parties. For instance, I mean, that's how the Republican Party began. In the 1850s, the Whig Party collapsed because of this slavery issue and the Kansas-Nebraska Act and all of that. And so this anti-slavery party, the Republican Party, sprung up in the North to replace the Whig Party. And something like that could happen again, but it would take a severe crisis, I think, for that to happen.
Oh, you don't, even though, like, right now Rand Paul is a Libertarian candidate for president, you don't think, you think it would take a crisis to get him into power?
Well, notice that you say he's a Libertarian candidate, which he is Libertarian, but notice that he's trying to work it through the Republican Party.
Right.
He's a Republican senator. I think he will probably run in 2016 as a Republican candidate, just as Ron Paul, his father, ran as a he also ran as a Libertarian, but the last couple of times ran as a Republican candidate. I think they see just how difficult it is to win the White House as a third party candidate. It would take a major crisis, I think, or major, at the very least, a major disappointment with the other two choices. I mean, Ross Perot did win 19% of the vote in 1992 because of dissatisfaction with both Democratic and Republican candidates. It is possible, but it's very difficult.
If we end up with, I mean, if he runs as a Republican candidate, but he's, I mean, we know that he's pretty Libertarian, is that not the same thing? Is that different somehow?
Well, but, you know, but that's usually the way it works, is that, for instance, in the late 1800s, there's the Populist Party arose, and they were unable to win the White House. They tried with William Jennings Bryan and so on. But what happens is, usually with the major parties, when they see a third party arising like that, what they do is they steal its platform, and they adopt it, they incorporate it, and then the third party dies out. And that could very well happen. I mean, especially if Rand Paul is the nominee in 2016, you basically see him taking Libertarians into the Republican Party on a greater scale than now. And that's actually probably the most successful way to get that kind of change is by taking over one of the major parties rather than coming around it with a third party.
Right. And so that's, I mean, is that not a political realignment when that happens?
Yes, and there have been major political realignments in American history, and it could happen again.
Right. Because that's what I see happening, whether it's 2016 or, you know, 2020 with a different candidate, that it seems like the Libertarian message is going to get there in the end.
Well, I see many conservatives, I think, have been, and I'm one of them, I think, have been moving in the Libertarian direction. And I think it's various things have the causes for that. One is the Fed is keeping on with printing and printing and printing more money, and people are becoming alarmed at that. The debt is getting out of hand. People are becoming more alarmed with that. And in foreign policy, people are, even many conservatives, have sort of gone from being neoconservatives to paleoconservatives. That is, they look at Afghanistan and Iraq, and they see these things as failures. And so they may not be completely Libertarian. They may want a more robust foreign policy than many Libertarians. But even so, they're moving in that direction.
Well, back before when we were discussing the left, you know, my sort of simplified, completely non-scientific model of a right-wing building phase, a left-wing stabilizing phase, and then a religion. The sort of pattern there is that the right tends to be aggressive and very logically focused. The left will push the moral case and reduce the focus on logic, and then religion switches from logic completely to faith. And as we switch further away from logic, it becomes harder to build and maintain a society. Does that pattern fit with any of the other countries that you studied?
It's a good question. Certainly in the case of Greece and Rome, these were very religious societies, especially Rome. But their religion was very different from the Judeo-Christian religions. That is, it was very exterior. That is, you did your sacrifices, you did what you were supposed to do, and you sort of punched your card and hoped for the best, hoped the gods would be pleased with you and would favor you. But it was not at all tied with belief. That is, the gods couldn't care less what you believed so long as you did the sacrifices. And that's why the Romans couldn't understand the Jews and the Christians. You know, they said, look, we're willing to add your God to our list of gods. Why won't you add our list of gods to your list? You know, the gods don't care what you believe just so long as you do the sacrifices. So it was a very different type of religion they followed.
They're also into Stoicism, which is something I've been looking at quite a bit.
The upper class, yes, the very well-educated people, not so much the masses, but the upper class were into Stoicism and other philosophies, and there was some commonality there with Christianity, which I think helped Christianity spread among the upper classes. For instance, in Stoicism, there is a belief in a kind of an afterlife. You know, your soul breaks off. When you're born, your soul comes from the world soul, and when you die, it goes back, which is a kind of afterlife. And similar moral, ethical systems. So there were some similarities there. Now, one of the things that happened, and Gibbon talks about this a lot, in the late Roman Empire, was that the Greek and Roman religions were declining as Christianity was rising. And he blamed Christianity. He believed that was one of the causes for the fall of the Roman Empire, because early Christianity was very much inwardly focused. And so great minds like St. Augustine, for instance, he was a natural Roman leader. I mean, if he had not been a Christian, he probably would have been in government, you know. And so you have all these Christians sort of retreating from society, looking inwardly, looking toward the next life as opposed to this life. And so Gibbon believed that was one of the main causes of the fall of the Roman Empire, is it was Christianity took all these minds out of, these great minds out of Roman society. They became, you know, these sort of celibate priests, bishops, living outside the system and not really, in Gibbon's mind, not really contributing to the system.
I think that happened.
Yeah, you mentioned the religion today and sort of leftist religion. I see that in things like, for instance, this global warming hysteria. I mean, the facts are pretty clear that in the last 10 to 15 years, there's been no warming at all. And in the past century and a quarter, since we've been keeping temperature records, the average temperature has only grown up about 1 degree Fahrenheit. And so there's no, you know, the facts, I think, are all opposed to this hysteria. But, and yet there's this imperviousness to facts, because I think it's a religion.
That's an aspect
of a religion.
The moral viewpoint book might be interesting for you. It is people just look through things through one filter and not through the other, and they miss things. It's like a blind spot from when you're driving.
Right. I mean, some of the things the leftists are saying, like, for instance, there's no debt problem. Well, I don't see how any human being who looks at the facts rationally, our debt is now more than 100% of our GDP. which is alarming. I mean, Greece was at about 120%, I believe, debt to GDP ratio, and we're now over 100%. We're headed toward Greek territory. And so for any rational person to say there's no debt problem, you know, there's a whole list of things like that, then you say, well, how can a rational person believe that? And I think it's a religion. I mean, their worldview has become a religion, and it's become impervious to fact.
Which is always a problem. who were some of the other founding fathers that were very active in this fall of Rome idea, and what documents, what were some of the other things that they influenced in the founding documents of the U.S.?
Well, it's actually easier to name the people who weren't influenced by the classics than the people that were, because it was such a deep part of the educational system. You didn't have a couple like Benjamin Franklin had only 1 year of formal education, because he was the 11th son in his relatively modest family. Thomas Paine also didn't have much classical education. So there are a few of those, but almost all of the others had quite a bit of classical education, and it influenced them in many different ways. Another thing in the early American Republic was this suspicion of political parties. I mean, Washington spent most of his farewell address as president warning against political parties. And today we scratch our heads and we say, well, how can you not have political parties in a free society? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. But from their vantage point, they look back to the Roman so-called parties or factions. In fact, the Latin word was factio. And the factio was, in Roman times, was part of the cause of the fall of their republic, because big political leaders like Caesar and Pompey, they built up these sort of parties, and these parties followed them, you know, to the death, and you end up with civil wars between parties. Caesar's party versus Pompey's party. And they actually took up arms, and there was civil war in Rome constantly in the late Republic. And so that's why someone like Washington would spend most of his farewell address warning against parties. He believed that we could have a civil war in the United States if these the parties in his day were the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans, that they might actually come to blows. And so that's one example of classical influence.
Can you tell me some of the, like we discussed earlier, the guns as a sort of a protection against the country drifting too far to the left. Can you tell me some other, I mean, effectively hacks that they did on the founding documents that are similar? Is there like a list of like 10 major things that they did?
10 major things that who did?
That the founding fathers did to protect the country from drifting too far to the left.
Oh, well, of course, the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, if you read them, they're all directed at the federal government. They say Congress shall not do this and Congress shall not do that. And the reason is the states already had bills of rights. They already had their own bills of rights. So they weren't too concerned about the states infringing on the rights of the people, partly because the states had their own bills of rights and partly because the states were closer to the people. And there was this idea that is the farther away you get from the people, the more likely government is to consider themselves apart from the people and therefore become tyrannical. And so you find that quite a bit. In fact, you know, this is one of the main things the anti-federalists feared about this new constitution, was that it was going to take power away from the states and give it to the federal government. And they were concerned that this distant city of Washington, D.C., would become corrupt and start considering itself separate from the people. In fact, there was an anti-federalist from New York, I believe it was. I know his last name was Treadwell. I think it was Robert Treadwell. But he actually, I think it was at the New York Ratifying Convention, he said that this new city, because one of the things the Constitution said was that we're going to create a new federal city, Washington, D.C., and he didn't like that at all, and he said that Washington would become, quote, a hive in which the drones will gather to eat the honey of the land.
Well, it's good that none of that's come true then.
Yeah, that's right. When I read that, I just about fell on the floor. I said, this guy was a prophet.
So we've got the Bill of Rights and then states' rights. Have you read the book Anti-Fragile?
No, I haven't.
So Anti-Fragile, actually, it talks about the concept of fragility and how you can make things anti-fragile, which means that they grow under pressure. And so what he talks about is that it's better to have a lot of small things being tested and pushed rather than one big thing that can become very brittle. The guy that wrote the book is he was the guy that wrote The Black Swan, and which is basically predicted the financial meltdown. So you might find that interesting. I found it very thoughtful, and a lot of the libertarian arguments of states' rights versus the central government fits along those lines. You mentioned the Bill of Rights as things that they did. You mentioned
Well, there's mixed government theory.
The mixed government, right? You mentioned that. What were some other things that were similar?
There were a lot of attention was placed to checks and balances, and so another theory, which is actually more modern, was the theory of the separation of powers, and that goes back to Baron de Montesquieu in the Enlightenment era, and. The idea is to balance the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. That one branch is going to make the laws, another branch will enforce the laws, and a third branch will interpret the laws and apply it to specific cases that are brought to its attention. Now, there's some overlap in that. You know, the president has a veto over legislation and so on. But this idea of separation of powers, that you don't give any one branch too much power. And this is something that's broken down in modern times, I think, because the executives have become stronger and stronger. And, we now see this with presidents from both parties doing things like legislating by executive order, which is, to me, unconstitutional. I mean, it's one thing if an executive order is just an instruction to the members of the executive department that this is how we interpret this particular law or something like that, or how we're going to apply it. But it's another thing to actually legislate, which both parties are doing, presidents of both parties, to actually legislate by executive order. I mean, that's unconstitutional. The Congress is the legislature, not the president. And then we have legislation by the bureaucrats in the executive branch. You know, the thousands and thousands of pages of regulations every year, and these have not been approved by Congress either. So that's legislation by the executive branch. So I see the separation of powers is breaking down as well.
Okay, I think we should leave it there. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to bring up?
No, not really.
We talked about a lot of stuff, didn't we?
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you very much for doing the interview.
Thank you.